Imagine it's late in the evening in March 1805 in Philadelphia. You're the British ambassador to the United States, and you're welcoming Aaron Burr into your study just days after he stepped down from the vice presidency. After a strange meeting with a friend of Burr's last year, you have a strong suspicion about why he wants to see you and why he's come after dark. You gesture toward a worn leather chair in the corner. Please, Mr. Burr, take your seat. I read your farewell speech to the Senate. The newspapers were impressed. I must congratulate you. Well, thank you. And now that your time as vice president has come to an end, I suppose you're planning your future. From what your friend told me last summer, I gather you've set your sights west. Burr nods as he leans back in the chair. Yes, indeed. And that's why I wanted to see you. It might interest you to know that the residents of Louisiana are determined to win their independence from the United States. But first, they need a promise of protection and assistance from a foreign power. And by foreign power, you are referring to His Majesty's government. Precisely. You don't beat around the bush, do you, sir? Burr shakes his head, his eyes flashing with excitement. Well, I'm sure you can imagine the benefits this would afford your country. What exactly are you planning, Mr. Burr? Well, it would be too dangerous to disclose any details at the present moment, but in regard to military aid, 2 or 3 frigates would do nicely, as well as 2 or 3 additional vessels to be stationed at the mouth of the Mississippi, to prevent a blockade, of course. 2 or 3 frigates. Yes, more than enough to match any naval force the United States could muster. Now, with respect to money, though, I believe a loan of about £100,000 should be well enough to begin the enterprise. More may be needed at a later date. I see. You know the potential gain for Britain would more than offset this initial cost. You nod, but think about all the challenges your country is up against. It's been 2 years since Britain declared war on France. The balance of power in Europe is at stake. Yes, but we're in the fight of our lives against Napoleon at the moment. His sphere of influence has grown dangerously large. And now you have a chance to expand the influence of His Majesty's government. The population of Louisiana is growing every day. Think of the trade opportunities. And you believe you can succeed in making Louisiana independent? Well, with enough guns and money, absolutely. But I urge you to write your superiors. See what they think as soon as possible. Before you can respond, you see Burr's eyes narrow. Because although I would prefer an ally in Britain, I am certain that France would eagerly support a movement for Western independence. Anything to regain easy access to trade on the Mississippi River. Burr folds his arms and sets his jaw in defiance. His message is clear. If Britain doesn't support him, he'll turn to your country's greatest enemy. Well, I will write London immediately. And as soon as I have a reply, I will be in touch. Burr rises and gives you a curt nod, then follows one of your servants out. You walk to your desk in search of paper, thoughts swirling through your mind. Burr's chance of success seems unlikely, but the American Revolution proved that secession is possible if the right people are in charge. And Burr still has connections and powerful friends. From what you've seen, he might also possess the sheer determination to pull off this daring scheme. American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. I like puzzles. I like adventure. I like clever people. I like things on the edge, which means I love mysteries, the perfect combination of storytelling, mental challenge, and often murder, like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals, ready to listen whenever, wherever, on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. That's audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. Listen to a new bold take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Ilan Ishkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. A chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion, now more relevant than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American History Tellers. Our history, your story. In March 1805, Aaron Burr completed his term as vice president. Just days later, he traveled to Philadelphia to call on Anthony Mary, Britain's ambassador to the United States. Burr was seeking military and financial aid from Great Britain for a plot to carve out a new country in the Louisiana Territory. It had been less than a year since Burr shot and killed his rival Alexander Hamilton in a duel. Since that time, Burr's reputation and finances were in shambles, but he refused to sink into obscurity. As his time in Washington came to a close, Burr hatched a conspiracy that he hoped would return him to power, and his plan would hinge on America's new frontier in the West. But Burr knew he could not do it alone. He would have to make the journey west across the Appalachian Mountains to seek allies and funds. His ever-shifting plans were audacious, but Burr was certain he would find glory and greatness on the frontier, no matter the risk. This is Episode 2, Gathering Forces. In mid-August 1804, a month after killing Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr boarded a ship in Philadelphia bound for Georgia. Earlier in August, the state of New York had indicted Burr for Hamilton's murder, so he decided to head south, hoping to disappear from the public eye and the threat of arrest. Burr sailed down the Atlantic coast, reaching Georgia at the end of August. He intended to tour Spanish-held Florida, but torrential rains forced him to turn back. Burr instead went to visit his daughter and her young family in South Carolina. As he traveled, he was surprised by the warm reception he received. Most Southerners had disliked Hamilton, believing his financial plans were a threat to their agrarian economy, so his death weighed less on their minds. Burr's travels gave him hope that he could still have a future in politics. But Burr still had problems, including his large amount of debt accumulated after years of living beyond his means. He arranged for the sale of his house and furniture to pay his bills, but he still owed several thousand dollars. Compounding this debt, as he returned north, he learned that a grand jury in New Jersey had also indicted him for murder. Now he was a wanted man in two states. Despite his fugitive status, Burr was still the sitting vice president. And fortunately for him, federal law did not yet provide a way to extradite criminals from the District of Columbia to other states. So Burr believed he could safely return to the nation's capital to fulfill his sole vice presidential duty, presiding over the new Senate session. On November 4, 1804, Burr called the Senate to order. The most pressing business was the impending impeachment trial of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase. President Jefferson and his fellow Republicans were hoping to oust the staunchly Federalist Chase on the grounds that he was letting his partisan leanings impact his decisions in court. The House had already impeached Chase, and soon the Senate would conduct a trial and decide whether to acquit or convict. As vice president, it was Burr's job to preside over the trial and maintain order and decorum. Alexander Hamilton had, of course, been a leading voice of the Federalists, and many of them were disgusted to see his killer in the Senate chamber instead of a jail cell. But Republicans were determined to impeach and remove Chase, and they treated Burr warmly in hopes of influencing his conduct during the trial. Burr joined James Madison for rides in his carriage, and the new Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin often visited Burr at his boarding house. Republicans even tried to help Burr with his legal troubles. A Virginia senator circulated a petition urging the New Jersey governor to stop prosecuting Burr, and 11 Republican senators signed on. One Federalist accused the Republicans of caressing Hamilton's murder, calling Burr an exception to all rules. But while Burr enjoyed his improved standings in the Capitol for his past behavior, behind the scenes he was still focused on his future. He had 4 months left as vice president, and he was determined to use them to his advantage. That fall, General James Wilkinson took lodgings near Burr's boarding house. Wilkinson was the U.S. Army's general-in-chief, but secretly he was also a paid agent for the Spanish crown. And 6 months earlier, he and Burr had met clandestinely for several days, huddling over maps of the western frontier. Now, in the final months of Burr's vice presidency, the pair continued their private conversations, meeting frequently at odd hours. Burr's landlord took notice. He later described their meetings, declaring that the pair kept a number of maps and charts of East and West Florida, of Orleans, of Louisiana, and of adjoining country. Wilkinson and Burr were secretly making plans to change the fate of America's new lands in the West. After the Louisiana Purchase was finalized in 1803, Congress divided the new territory at the 33rd parallel, located at the current north border of the state of Louisiana. Above this parallel was the Louisiana Territory. Below was the far more populated Orleans Territory. Cotton and sugar plantations blanketed the rich soil of the Orleans Territory, and crops moved through the bustling port of New Orleans. But the territory's eastern and western borders were in dispute. Both the United States and Spain claimed ownership over parts of Texas and West Florida. Some Americans feared the competing claims would spark war between the two nations, and a number of Western settlers coveted Spanish lands for themselves. Many of these had only a superficial attachment to the United States. In 1804, America still did not have a strong national identity. The Constitution was just 15 years old, and the federal government's reach was limited. West of the Appalachians, American settlers faced a harsh and unpredictable existence. Their communities were remote, and therefore largely ungoverned. Violence frequently erupted, and disease was a constant threat. The ruggedness of frontier life fostered a fierce sense of independence, and as a result, secession movements sprang up throughout the West. Loyalty to the Union was especially weak in New Orleans. The city was populated by French-speaking Creoles, who resented falling under American control. With the stroke of a pen, the Louisiana Purchase had imposed America's language, laws, and taxes on them. In this volatile landscape, Burr saw opportunity, and he took comfort knowing that whatever form his plans ultimately took, he could rely on General Wilkinson for manpower to execute them. As the senior commander of U.S. forces in the West, Wilkinson could move troops without arousing suspicion. And during that winter in Washington, he was already proving himself to be a trustworthy ally. Imagine it's early December 1804 in Washington, D.C. You're a cotton planter from New Orleans, and you've traveled more than 1,000 miles on behalf of your fellow Creoles. You're here to present a petition to Congress listing your grievances against the United States government. After a long day of meetings, you're sitting in the corner of a tavern near the Capitol. You look up from your wine glass as a man with a generous build and a gold-buttoned uniform walks toward you with a smile.
Well, look who it is. Bonjour, monsieur. Hello, General.
You recognize the man as General James Wilkinson. You met him a year ago, when he led troops into New Orleans to finalize the French handover to the United States. The very action that's ultimately brought you here to D.C.
Is this seat taken? Oh, no, be my guest.
Wilkinson drops into the seat across from you, spilling ale from his pewter tankard.
How fortunate to find you here. Any luck in Congress? Oh, so you know my business there. No, not yet. We're holding another meeting tomorrow. Well, best of luck to you then, too. You know, you have my sympathies.
Well, thank you, General.
Did you know Congress has banned us from acquiring new foreign slaves? They don't understand how high our mortality rates are. We need more slaves or our plantations will be ruined.
Wilkinson nods fiercely.
Quite right. Imposed a horrible burden on you. This nation was founded upon cries of taxation without representation. But we lack any semblance of democratic self-government. Are we not now U.S. citizens? Or are we colonial subjects? It is an outrage, and I completely agree.
Wilkinson leans forward, his eyes darting across the room, making sure no one is listening.
And you know, you should share your concerns with Aaron Burr. The vice president, what does he have to do with this? He's a brilliant politician, and he won't be vice president for much longer.
I'm afraid I don't follow.
If he's no longer the vice president, what use is he? Well, as soon as his term ends, Burr plans to travel through the Louisiana Territory. He has certain projects in mind there.
Huh.
And what kind of projects?
Wilkinson takes a swig of ale and gives you a conspiratorial grin.
Oh, you know, Burr is the type of man who succeeds in everything he tries. You would do well to give him all the information you can about your lands and how you would like them to be governed.
Wilkinson slams his tankard down on the table and rises from his seat. With a wink, he turns around and walks back toward the bar. You stare after him in confusion. If you're not mistaken, it seems that the general who helped secure possession of the Louisiana Territory
is now plotting against his own government. But if Aaron Burr is truly willing to help fight for the interests of New Orleans, it may be worth your while to listen. In December 1804, Creole delegates from New Orleans arrived in Washington with a petition of grievances. General Wilkinson urged them to speak with Aaron Burr. He noted that Burr was especially interested in local opinion about Mexico and how much popular support residents had for the Union. The Creole delegates followed Wilkinson's advice and befriended Burr, who looked forward to visiting New Orleans for himself. But while Burr was making his plans for a journey west, he still had a job to do in the East. In January 1805, the impeachment trial of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase began in the Senate. As vice president and head of the Senate, Burr took lead over the proceedings, interrogating witnesses. He worked hard to be impartial, despite pressure from Jefferson and the Republicans to sway the outcome. His even-handed conduct won him respect, even from politicians and reporters who disliked him. A Massachusetts congressman declared, "I could almost forgive Burr for any less crime than the blood of Hamilton, for the decision, dignity, firmness, and impartiality with which he presides in this trial." On March 1, 1805, the Senate acquitted Justice Chase. The next day, Burr delivered a farewell address to the Senate that left some members in tears. He spoke about the rule of law and the Senate's duty to fight what he called the sacrilegious hands of the demagogue or the usurper. Burr left the office of vice president on March 4th. A few days later, Jefferson unknowingly gave Burr a parting gift when he appointed Wilkinson as governor of the Louisiana Territory. Jefferson had no idea about his scheming with Burr, but soon Wilkinson would move to St. Louis and take up his new role. Shortly after, on March 13th, Burr left Washington for Philadelphia. His career in government was over, but he could not return to his home in New York without facing arrest. He had debts hanging over him, too, and because of his legal troubles, he could no longer earn an income by practicing law. Writing to his son-in-law, he declared, "In New York, I am to be disenfranchised, and in New Jersey, hanged. Having substantial objections to both, I shall not for the present hazard either, but shall seek another country." Burr planned an expedition to the Orleans Territory. From Philadelphia, he would go to Pittsburgh, then down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers before finally reaching New Orleans. He hoped to meet wealthy and influential Westerners along the route and wanted to gauge their sentiment toward the Union. But before he left Philadelphia, Burr had some other important business to attend to. First, he joined a plan to dig a canal in Indiana at the falls of the Ohio River. The canal project would be the official reason for Burr's journey west. Next, he arranged to meet with British Ambassador Anthony Mary. The previous August, through a friend, Burr had offered his services to Mary to effect a separation of the western part of the United States. But this time, Burr told Mary himself that the residents of Louisiana might be persuaded to secede from the United States if they could secure an assurance of protection and assistance from some foreign power. Mary reported the meeting to officials in Britain, declaring, "Mr. Burr intends to be the instrument of effecting such a connection." But Burr needed Britain to provide guns, ships, and money. He asked Mary for 2 or 3 frigates and a loan of about £100,000. Mary was impressed by Burr's confidence, and he encouraged London officials to support the scheme. Meanwhile, Burr finalized preparations for his trip. Newspapers reported that Burr was journeying west for business related to his Ohio River Canal project. But Burr had other plans in mind. Just days after stepping down from the vice presidency of the United States, Burr was conspiring to divide that very nation in two. American History Tellers is sponsored by Dell Technologies. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. Dell pushes what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcome to now. That's Dell.com/welcome to now. American History Tellers is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. I can ask, "Do you speak English?" in 4 languages. Super useful when traveling, second only to "Where's the restroom?" But that's survival-only vocabulary. When I travel, I want to do more than survive. I want to laugh, marvel, and commune. Hard to do if you can't speak the language. And that's why there's Rosetta Stone.
the most trusted language learning program, desktop or mobile, that truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone's been a trusted expert for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Immerse yourself, learning to speak, listen, and think in a new language so you retain what you learn. Then polish your command of the language with the built-in True Accent feature, just like a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started, because for a very limited time, American History Tellers listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/tellers. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/tellers today.
In April 1805, Aaron Burr boarded a 60-foot houseboat in Pittsburgh and set off down the Ohio River. For his plans to succeed, he would need to move men and supplies from population centers in Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee down to New Orleans and the Southwest. And for that, he would need a base on the Ohio River, which flowed into the Mississippi. On May 5th, 12 miles downriver from the town of Marietta, Ohio, Burr found such a base. Blennerhassett Island was a narrow 300-acre strip of land in the middle of the Ohio River. It was owned by a wealthy and eccentric Irish immigrant named Harmon Blennerhassett. Back in Ireland, Blennerhassett had caused a scandal by marrying his own niece, Margaret. To escape, the couple fled Europe for the remote American frontier. Burr had never met the Blennerhassetts, but he carried a letter of introduction from a mutual friend. The couple invited Burr to dine with them in their mansion. And while there is no record of their conversation, Burr likely described his plans for a lucrative invasion of Mexico, something that would have appealed to Blennerhassett, whose fortunes were declining. Whatever was discussed, the dinner would prove fateful. As Burr continued developing his plot, Blennerhassett Island would form a key part of his plans. Burr used the next leg of his journey to reconnect with friends and form powerful new acquaintances, from politicians and militia officers to wealthy businessmen. In Cincinnati, he called on Jonathan Dayton, an old friend from his days at Princeton University. Dayton was a signer of the Constitution and a former New Jersey senator. Now, he would become one of Burr's closest confidants. During his travels, Burr was careful to tailor his appeals to the interests of each individual listener. Sometimes he emphasized the many ways the eastern U.S. was taking advantage of the West, or the many perceived failings of the Jefferson administration. Other times he talked up the prospect of leading troops against Spanish forces in Mexico and the vast land holdings and natural resources that lay waiting there. But he never revealed the full extent of his plans. Burr soon left Cincinnati for Louisville, where he abandoned his houseboat. He continued on horseback through Kentucky and Tennessee. As a former vice president, he was one of the most prominent Americans to ever cross the Appalachians, and everywhere he went, he was met with parades and formal dinners. On May 30th, Nashville welcomed him with a cannon salute. There he stayed with General Andrew Jackson, a former congressman and future president. Burr was especially interested in the 2,000 Tennessee militiamen under Jackson's command. The pair bonded over their mutual frustrations with the Spanish, and Jackson threw a ball in Burr's honor. After a few days, Jackson provided Burr another boat to travel down the Cumberland River, which flowed back into the Ohio. Then in early June, Burr met up with General Wilkinson at Fort Massac, an outpost on the Ohio River about 35 miles east of where it met with the Mississippi. Wilkinson outfitted Burr with an army barge and gave him letters of introductions to friends in New Orleans. And later that month, on June 25th, Burr finally reached New Orleans, where he planned to gauge public opinion about the possible invasion of Mexico and find potential supporters. Like Burr, many New Orleans residents resented the United States government and hungered for Spanish land. So Burr knew that this city would be central to his plans for the West, and he was determined to win favor with its residents. Imagine it's a hot, muggy night in New Orleans, June 1805. You're a cotton merchant, and you're at a grand ball where the guest of honor is former Vice President Aaron Burr. You're skirting the perimeter of the dance floor in search of the esteemed visitor. And finally, you see him, speaking to a trio of young women.
Mr. Vice President, I hate to interrupt you, but may I speak with you for a moment?
Burr nods, then turns back to one of the ladies, pressing a kiss to the back of her hand.
please save a dance, won't you? The woman gives Burr a shy smile and walks away with her friends. Burr watches her go for a moment before turning his gaze on you.
Yes, sir, you have my undivided attention. Well, thank you, sir. May I ask what brings you to New Orleans? It's not often we see such eminent men travel all the way to the Gulf Coast.
Well, I'm a Francophile at heart. I've always longed to visit this city. And now that I'm here, well, I've found much to enjoy, especially the company.
Burr glances back toward the women he was just speaking to. You're not so sure about his attention being undivided, but you press on.
Well, I myself relish the business prospects we have here, especially given how close we are to Mexico. I take it you've met Daniel Clark? He's been quite successful in his endeavors there.
At the mention of Daniel Clark, Burr fixes you with an intense stare. He takes you by the arm and pulls you into a corner.
I did make Mr. Clark's acquaintance and found him to be a very impressive man. Tell me, what do you know about his Mexico association?
Oh, I know plenty.
Clark wants to liberate Mexico from Spanish rule. Mexico is a land of opportunity, I tell you, full of sugar plantations and silver mines. And everyone knows Spain has become too weak to govern it.
Burr's face darkens.
Yes, I agree. The United States should seize Mexico for itself. But Jefferson is far too reluctant. I'll never understand how our country can elect a president who's never been a soldier.
You raise your glass.
Well, cheers to that. Do you know that the French army left behind more than 50 cannons here in New Orleans? But Jefferson declined to purchase them. The man has no military sense at all.
Suddenly, Burr's eyes light up.
50 cannons? Well, with those and a few thousand troops, Mexico could be ripe for the taking. If war doesn't come, New Orleans should act independently. Well, that's what Clark thinks, too. But I'm not sure your peace-loving President Jefferson would stand for such an action. But who cares what Jefferson thinks? With 50 cannons, we can do more than annex Mexico. We could separate New Orleans from the Union, too. Oh, careful, sir. You're starting to sound seditious.
Burr smiles and shakes his head.
Well, I jest, of course. But we could gain much from an expedition against Mexico. All we need is the funding. Well, I'd be happy to introduce you to some of my friends in business. I'd like that very much. Now, if you'll excuse me, I think a young lady owes me a dance.
Burr grasps your arm in gratitude and then walks off. You're thrilled to have such a prominent man understand the interests of New Orleans so clearly. With Burr on your side, you might actually have a chance of seizing Mexico and acquiring its riches. Burr enjoyed his time in New Orleans in the summer of 1805, especially forming ties with a secret cabal known as the Mexico Association. This shadowy group of 300 traders and adventurers wanted to invade and seize northern Mexico, despite such an act being in violation of U.S. neutrality law. And Burr soon won the trust of Daniel Clark, a wealthy merchant and leading member of the Mexico Association. Clark hosted a dinner in Burr's honor and pledged $50,000, more than $1 million in today's money, in support of a private expedition against Mexico. And Burr was delighted to learn that the French army had indeed left 55 cannons behind in the city, sparing him from having to acquire artillery elsewhere. After 3 weeks, Burr left New Orleans to return to Philadelphia. To avoid the difficulty of traveling upriver, most Easterners sailed home along the Gulf and Atlantic coasts. But Burr wanted to see more of the country, so he embarked on a punishing overland journey through dense wilderness. Along the way, he continued nurturing his new friendships and recruiting men for his new enterprise. But while Burr traveled north, rumors about his plans began to spread. In early August 1805, a Federalist newspaper in Philadelphia speculated that Burr was plotting rebellion and foreign invasion. The editors declared, "How long will it be before we hear of Colonel Burr being at the head of a revolution party on the Western waters? How soon will Colonel Burr engage in the conquest of Mexico by granting liberty to its inhabitants and seizing on its treasures?" Other newspapers quickly joined in and recirculated the speculation. But the rumors did nothing to stop Burr from moving forward. By November 1805, he was back in Washington. He had accomplished his aim of acquiring friends, political supporters, and promises of money on his recent journey. Now he would shift his focus to securing foreign backers. In late November 1805, Burr sat down with President Jefferson at the Executive Mansion. He had one topic on his mind: the rumblings of war with Spain over border disputes in Texas and West Florida. Burr hoped that if a war started on the Spanish border, Jefferson would order General Wilkinson to Louisiana with soldiers in the name of protecting U.S. sovereignty. This would give official cover for Wilkinson to invade Mexico on Burr's behalf, seizing land for Burr's new empire. Burr also believed that if a war broke out, he might even be given command of his own militia, which would enable him to start a secessionist rebellion in New Orleans, while Wilkinson fought the Spanish in Mexico. But Burr left his meeting with Jefferson disappointed. The president was set on finding a peaceful solution and had no intention of going to war with Spain. Undeterred, Burr used the rest of his time in Washington to continue to pursue an alliance with Great Britain. The same week he sat down with Jefferson, he once again called on British Ambassador Anthony Mary. Burr told Mary that he planned to launch his own expedition against Mexico in March 1806, just 4 months away. He pressed Mary again for assistance, but the ambassador told Burr that he had heard nothing yet from London. Still unsure whether he had British support, Burr developed another backup plan. He had his friend Jonathan Dayton meet with the Spanish ambassador, Carlos Martinez Irujo, in early December of 1805. The Spanish feared the threat of war with America. So Dayton led Irujo to believe that Burr had abandoned any plans of invading Mexico and instead planted the idea that Burr's only goal was to lead a rebellion in New Orleans. Dayton painted a picture of an independent nation on the western frontier, one that could act as a buffer between Mexico and the United States. He also insisted that Britain had promised to support Burr's plans and described how the arrival of British warships in New Orleans would trigger an uprising in the city. But just a few days later, Dayton met with Irujo again and admitted that he lied about British support. Instead, he unveiled an even bolder scheme, the capture of Washington, D.C. Dayton told Irujo that Burr would have soldiers seize control of Washington, empty its banks, and set sail for New Orleans. Once Burr arrived there, he would win the city's independence and break the United States' power in the Southwest. Dayton asked Irujo for money from the Spanish crown to fund the scheme. This proposal to capture the nation's capital was a dramatic escalation in Burr's plans. Irujo called the plot almost insane, but was nevertheless intrigued. He wrote officials in Madrid recommending that Spain help pay for Burr's audacious plan. He declared, "Spain would view with extreme satisfaction the dismemberment of the colossal power, growing up at the very gates of her most precious and important colonies." Irujo even gave Dayton and Burr a few $1,000 to get started. And while Burr was making overtures to the British and the Spanish, he remained in contact with allies from his riverboat journey in the West. In early December 1805, he wrote Harmon Blennerhassett, alluding to the opportunities he could offer the Irishman. On December 21st, Blennerhassett replied, declaring, "Viewing the probability of a rupture with Spain, I am disposed, in the confidential spirit of this letter, to offer you my own services." Burr could now count on the help of Blennerhassett and his strategically useful island property. Burr had gathered friends, supporters, and funds, but his plotting and scheming had not gone unnoticed. Soon, warnings of Burr's conspiracy against the United States would reach its chief executive, and President Jefferson was about to hear that his former vice president was threatening revolution. American History Tellers is sponsored by NetSuite. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, switch to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you'll reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud, no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/tellers. That's netsuite.com/tellers. netsuite.com/tellers. American History Tellers is sponsored by Field of Greens. I turned 50 this past February, and at milestones like these, you start to make promises. This is the year I get healthy, you might say, or the year I pay attention to what I eat.
Because even if you're turning just 30, you're not the same spring chicken you were. And turning 40? Well, that's when you really start to notice. So at 50, I'm definitely paying more attention to my body. Exercising, eating well, and finding ways to improve my health that are actually things I can accomplish. Field of Greens is one of those. It's literally one scoop a day, packed with organic fruit and vegetables to support heart and vital organ health. My first shipment is arriving this week, and it'll become part of my morning routine. Maybe it should be part of yours. Field of Greens offers a 100% money-back guarantee, so it's a no-risk, easy step towards better nutrition. Plus, I've got you 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Just visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code AHT. That's promo code AHT at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. In December 1805, two anonymous letters about Aaron Burr landed on President Jefferson's desk. The first referred to the meeting Burr held with Jefferson in November. It declared, "You held a long and private conference with Burr a few days ago, at the very moment he is meditating the overthrow of your administration and, what is more, conspiring against the state." The second letter described Burr's plans to invade Mexico. But it declared Burr's true object, the destruction of our government, your ruin, and the material injury of the Atlantic states. Then in January 1806, Jefferson received a third warning. This one was not anonymous. It was from Joseph Hamilton Davis, a federal district attorney from Kentucky and the brother-in-law of Supreme Court Justice John Marshall. Davis was a staunch Federalist, so much so that he adopted Hamilton as his middle name as an adult in honor of his hero, the former Treasury Secretary. In his letter, Davis did not mention Burr by name, but he told President Jefferson that General James Wilkinson was a paid agent of Spain and that he was involved in a plot to separate Western territory from the Union. Jefferson sent a reply in February, asking Davis to collect more information. As news of his plot was reaching the president, Burr was focused on recruiting disaffected U.S. military leaders. One of them was an army officer named William Eaton. In March 1805, Eaton had led American and foreign troops across North Africa to protect American trade routes. Against unlikely odds, Eaton won a crucial victory and returned home a national hero. But his efforts cost him dearly. He paid for the campaign out of his own pocket, and Congress refused to reimburse him. In his bitterness, he turned to alcohol and developed a reputation for heavy drinking. In Burr's mind, Eaton had plenty of reason to resent the federal government and possibly even turn against it. Throughout that winter in Washington, Burr slowly revealed his plans to Eaton. He spoke about conquering Mexico and his plans to start a revolution in New Orleans. But Burr also had a more shocking proposal. According to Eaton, Burr said that if he could secure the Marine Corps and naval commanders, he would turn Congress neck and heels out of doors, assassinate the president, seize on the Treasury and Navy, and declare himself the protector of an energetic government. But in trying to cultivate Eaton as a military ally, Burr miscalculated. When Burr asked Eaton to recruit naval officers into the plot, Eaton refused. Instead, he became determined to spread the alarm about Burr's conspiracy. Imagine it's March 1806 in Washington, D.C., at the Capitol building. You're a U.S. Army officer, and for months you've been hounding Congress to pay you back for your expenditures during the war on North Africa's Barbary Coast. Today you're here with a piece of information that you hope will help you win favor with government officials. You corner a congressman from Massachusetts just as he walks out the House chamber.
Congressman, I hoped I'd find you here.
You block the congressman's path as he tries to step around you, avoiding your gaze.
I'm afraid I don't have any news about the money. I'm sure you'll be reimbursed in due course. But I have a pressing matter to discuss with you. Something more pressing than finding your next drink? It must be important.
You take a deep breath to steady your nerves, trying your best to ignore the pointed comment.
Congressman, I must tell you that I've spoken at length with Aaron Burr. I have reason to believe he's planning a secret expedition into Spanish territory.
Well, good. Then he'll be all Spain's problem. I never liked him.
But listen to me. Burr is planning a revolution in New Orleans. He wants to start a secessionist rebellion. He's plotting to establish a new Western nation with himself as emperor.
The congressman looks at you in confusion.
What are you talking about? And that's not all. He's even thinking about trying to seize control of the government here in Washington. He told me that once he has the military in his grasp, he plans to throw out Congress. He wants to assassinate the president so he can declare himself sovereign. This is nonsense. I've never heard anything so ridiculous. Please, if you'll excuse me.
You throw up your hands, desperate to make him listen.
Please, Congressman, I'm trying to tell you. Aaron Burr is plotting treason. Something must be done.
Sir, you are a drunkard who hates President Jefferson and this administration. I do not know what your game is, but I have absolutely no reason to trust your word.
But you trust Aaron Burr, the man who killed Hamilton? The traitor to two parties? He has a long history of duplicity, and now he has nothing to lose. Please, you must believe me.
The congressman's shoulders clench, and for a second, there's a flash of recognition and fear in his eyes.
Well, I won't dispute that Burr is a dangerous man. But where is your proof of all of this? I would be more than happy to share all of that. All I ask in return is that Congress pay off my debts from the Barbary War.
But immediately, you see that mentioning your debts was a mistake. The congressman sets his jaw and fixes you with a contemptuous stare.
Oh, now I understand. Go bother someone else with your nonsense. I do not have the time for this.
The congressman rushes off, and you're frustrated to be dismissed. But you won't back down. You are certain that your knowledge of Burr's scheme will be the key to winning over the administration. If there's any hope of getting the money you're owed, your only choice may be to go directly to President Jefferson himself. Soon after hearing about Burr's plans to seize Washington, Eaton relayed the information to two congressmen. Both lawmakers dismissed him. To them, Eaton was untrustworthy, and the scheme he described too outlandish to be believed. So Eaton went to the executive mansion to warn the president himself. He suggested that Jefferson get Burr out of the country by awarding him a diplomatic post, but Jefferson refused. Over the course of several months, Jefferson had received multiple warnings that Burr was hatching a plot against the United States, but he had taken no action against his former vice president. On principle, Jefferson hated conflict. He had faith in the loyalty of Western citizens, and he hoped Burr's plans, if they were real, would fizzle out from lack of support. As a Republican, he preferred local public opinion to decide the issue rather than executive military power. And crucially, the warnings came from sources that Jefferson did not trust. Eaton had a reputation for drinking, and he was known to harbor frustrations with the administration. And the other most prominent source of Burr rumors, Joseph Hamilton Davis, was a passionate Federalist. Jefferson had reason to believe accusations against Burr were politically motivated. Meanwhile, by late March 1806, as the warnings of conspiracy accumulated, Burr was growing desperate. He had originally planned to launch his expedition that month, but he had still not heard back from the British or the Spanish, and he worried his funds were insufficient to pay for the weapons, boats, and soldiers he thought he needed. Burr wanted a contingency plan in case his more ambitious schemes failed, so he called on President Jefferson again and asked him for a position in the federal government, either in the cabinet or as ambassador to France or Britain. He hinted that if Jefferson refused, Burr could do the administration much harm. But Jefferson rejected Burr's request, telling him that the public had lost confidence in him. Jefferson left the meeting disliking his former vice president more than ever, especially after Burr's veiled threat. But Jefferson still did not believe that Burr posed a danger to the Republic. Soon after Jefferson denied him a job, Burr wrote to General Wilkinson, telling him that he was postponing their expedition until December. He turned his focus then to fundraising, contacting friends who might help him bankroll his plans. And he arranged to buy a 300,000-acre tract of land known as the Bastrop Land. This tract was near the Ouachita River on the present-day border of Louisiana and Arkansas, not far from Mexico. Burr believed the Bastrop Tract would be the ideal start to start a war with the Spanish, but it could also provide him with cover for moving soldiers throughout the Southwest. If anyone asked, he could simply say he was settling men on his land, and if his plans for war against the Spanish failed, he could still use the Bastrop Tract, making a fresh start as a frontier landowner. But while Burr was working out his land deal in late April, news reached Washington of military movements in the Southwest. Spanish soldiers were marching near American settlements on the Sabine River, the disputed unofficial boundary between Louisiana and Texas. President Jefferson ordered General Wilkinson to New Orleans to help reinforce the border. Burr was thrilled to hear that a military conflict with the Spanish was finally brewing.
More confident than ever, he intensified his fundraising and recruiting efforts. He reached out once again to Spanish Ambassador Irujo and British Ambassador Mary, seeking their respective nations' alliances for his breakaway republic. Neither man was able to offer money or military support, but undeterred, Burr forged ahead. In late July 1806, Burr issued his orders. He told Blennerhassett he would arrive at his island by late August and make it his staging ground. Jonathan Dayton, the former U.S. senator in Ohio, would assist with supplies. Other Burr allies sailed to New Orleans to help recruit there. At long last, Burr was ready to launch an army, the first step in bringing his plot to life and establishing a new and rival American empire. From Wondery, this is episode 2 of our 4-part series, The Burr Conspiracy, from American History Tellers. On the next episode, Western newspapers reveal Burr's plot to foment secession and invade Mexico. And while Burr readies his forces, chief co-conspirator James Wilkinson starts having second thoughts, jeopardizing the success of the mission. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to American History Tellers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. American History Tellers is hosted, edited, and produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written by Ellie Stanton. Edited by Dorian Marina. Produced by Alita Rozanski. Our production coordinator is Desi Blaylock. Managing producer is Matt Gant. Senior managing producer, Tanja Thigpen. Senior producer is Andy Herman. Executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out 6 pop culture-themed trophies for 6 basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.